Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, October 16, 2018. South Sudanese lawmakers endorse the September 12th peace deal.
The people of South Sudan are going to enjoy the outcome of it. We urge our people as representatives to build consensus around this agreement so that this agreement brings back the normalcy and reunite people of South Sudan once again.
And the spokesman of the National Salvation Front says his group did not start the fighting in Yei.
If we don't fight back, we'll be annihilated. And in the process, of course, civilians also get injured. But for this particular incident that happened in Minyori, the destruction of that base is necessary because will have even helped the civilians who have been tormented by this particular renegade.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Some local farmers and entrepreneurs in South Sudan say they need better security and roads that can link them to urban markets so they can sell their products. The farmers and entrepreneurs are taking part in a five-day Made in South Sudan exhibition which opened in Juba yesterday. Dimo Silva Aurelio reports for VOA from Juba.
We have tomato, eggplant, sweet melon, cucumber, kuma, spinach, and green chili. As you can see, our product is very. So I don't see the function for us to go in Uganda, Kenya to bring things while we have beautiful soil here we can produce without chemicals.
That is farmer Agwek Ring, who has locally made products on exhibit from her farm in Juba's Bilfarm neighborhood at the Made in South Sudan exhibition, an initiative aimed at promoting products produced by local farmers. Some farmers at the Made in South Sudan exhibition say they are proud of their produce and believe they can sell them in local, regional, and even international markets. Equatoria area farmers here say they even produce surplus food at times, but are unable to sell it in food insecure areas due to the poor road network. One farmer, Jimmy Anam, says above all, the country's leaders must end the conflict and improve the capacity of local farmers to produce competitive produces so they can produce food to curb persistent food shortages across South Sudan.
We have vegetables which can yield within 3 months. You have your tomatoes, you have your kodra, you have everything. So it is possible that we can easily chase away hunger as South Sudanese. When we go to the competitive market, you find that we can produce better quality maize that can compete within the region.
That is Jimmy Anam, who works for Afro Organic Company, which farms an area of land in Juba's Rajaf neighborhood that produces food and sells seedlings to several local farmers.
We produce seeds multiplication program, and also we deal in things that can be consumed by the community. Like, for example, here we have things like groundnuts, where we produce for seeds and as well as for consumption. From groundnuts, we can produce paste, which we make it possible to make ready for consumption. We do products like maize in big quantities. We do other things like millet and plus small vegetables, all kinds of vegetables.
Anam says his group has produced 600 metric tons of maize this year, which he says he wants to sell internationally.
As Afroganics, we are really happy that we, the South Sudanese, are able to do things on our own, and we can produce as much better products than any other country.
More than 60 South Sudanese companies working in agriculture and handcrafted products have their wares on display at the exhibit in Juba. Christine Igino, one of the exhibition's organizers, says it is time South Sudanese take advantage of the country's fertile soil and favorable farming environment.
They are producing, but they have no market because they have not been seen even that they are doing something. But through exhibition, you can expose them to the world. We'll expose them, even the products they're producing.
Many of the farmers at the exhibition says they have no idea how to find new markets for their product, either inside or outside the country. Paul Akech Mayom, South Sudan's Minister for Trade and East African Community Affairs, says his ministry will work to find markets for products made in South Sudan, both locally and regionally, and notes the recent deal President Salva Kiir recently reached with Chinese company to build new roads in South Sudan in exchange for crude oil. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
As the world marks the World Food Today, the head of the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization in South Sudan, says South Sudanese should develop other alternatives to avoid heavy reliance on food aid. For VOA News Manyang, David Mayar has more from Juba.
As a family, we share life together for survival. We work, we get some part-time work, and we work. And even people in the village also, they're providing food for us with some products, those who are they have been cultivating during this season. But it's not enough food, as it is well known scientifically, enough food, which means a lot.
That is Charles Edward, a resident of Juba, talking about his daily struggle to find food for his family. Speaking at an event to mark the World Food Day in Juba today, Pierre Boutier, the FAO country director, says many South Sudanese families need food donations.
The people needing food assistance immediately at 6.1 million people, which is, for the population living in South Sudan, more or less 60%, close to 60% of the population. This is a major crisis. This major crisis is due, of course, to the insecurity, but the insecurity is driving the movement of population, cutting them from livelihood, and then they're starting to starve.
Boutier says FAO and other humanitarian organizations are responding in various ways to help families in South Sudan cope with food shortages. He says FAO is also training communities on how to sustain their livelihoods. According to World Food Programme, 5 million South Sudanese rely on food provided by the aid agencies at the moment. Onyoti Odigo is South Sudan Agriculture and Food Security Minister. He says many South Sudanese have difficulties finding food for their families. Odigo says his ministry is mobilizing farmers across the country to ensure South Sudan becomes a food-secure nation within the next 5 years.
We need to organize small farmers into agriculture cooperatives, which is key for feeding the people. Our people, we are trying to organize them, if we are able to organize them in cooperatives, so that we help them and they will be able to support themselves. We need to invest in agriculture for food security and economic viability of the country.
Odigo says South Sudanese need large-scale food production so that the country can have enough food for her population. South Sudan allocates only 2.07 billion South Sudanese pounds in the 2017-2018 fiscal year budget. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayar in Juba.
The Minister of Information in Yei River State is condemning the recent fighting between SPLM-IO and the National Salvation Front, also known as NAS. Alfred Kenneth Duku is calling on CITISAM and the United Nations mission in South Sudan to investigate and report any group that started the fighting. NAS spokesman Samuel Suba says his group was attacked by SPLM-IO forces.
The problem of Yei River State, the insecurity started almost 2 months ago, where the skirmishes or conflict, physical confrontation between the government forces and the SPLM-IO in the areas of Kopera. This is the usual thing that has been happening. Unfortunately, on 14, which is 2 days ago, a small patrolling contingency, which was passing through Minyari area in Yei, Bayam, came under attack from a colonel called Gadi. And the colonel has been operating that area independently, even if he's an IO soldier.
Minyari area is under whose control? Who controls that area?
There's no specific armed opposition group that controls that area. Only that that guy is independently operating in that area and is causing havoc to civilians, looting, abducting, detaining people. And this is the same guy in June who abducted 10 NGO staff, and including the three vehicles.
And you need to answer this, because a lot of South Sudanese are wondering, why are you fighting each other? The IO and NAS, why are you fighting each other? At the end of the day, it's the common people who are displaced and they are suffering. Why are you fighting in Yei River State?
Some of these IO forces in Yei River State, they behave like the government. They have the same ideology as the government in Juba. The government in Juba is restricting, is not giving space to some people to exercise their political rights. Some of these IOs in ways also have that mentality that they own the whole bush, and therefore no other opposition will be there. So since the formation of the National Salvation Front, we never attacked IO. Instead, IO has been attacking our forces, and we have been defending ourselves.
And in the process of defending yourself, it's the common people that you claim to fight for who are suffering. I mean, how do you react to that?
Definitely, when we are defending ourselves, it will have some ramifications. One is that our forces, if we don't fight back, will be annihilated. And in the process, of course, civilians also get annihilated. But for this particular incident that happened in Minyori, the destruction of that base is necessary because will have even helped the civilians who have been tormented by this particular renegade all this time.
Yei River State seems to be very strategic to the NAS people and the IO. Is it because of the resources there?
It is strategic because most of our forces are local boys. They come from that area. And you remember the war has been forced on us by the government in Juba. They are ethnocentric behaviors, and therefore all these people decided to rebel so that they defend their rights, they defend their political stand, they defend whatever belongs to their heritage, and therefore that's why our forces are there. And of course, I don't know, I don't speak on behalf of IO what interest they are having. They will have to justify why they are keen to maintain their positions in those locations.
But how come the IO are only fighting with you and not other political forces in the country? Why National Salvation Front? Why do you fight with IO?
The answer is the same as what I said before, that some of these people behave the way you will behave. They wanted to dominate the political space. They believe that they are the only legitimate political group that has the capacity to fight the government, and there is no any other force that must fight or have an alternative political idea in South Sudan. And that's why they're attacking us for that matter.
And when is this going to end? I mean, there is peace in the country, signed in September. When are you going to stop fighting each other?
The best question is to ask them and the government, why are they also fighting in Kupera, in Wau, and the like, and they are signatories? We don't expect, if they are fighting us, it's justified because we are not signatories to the agreement. But they themselves are fighting themselves. So the question is the peace holding?
That's Soba Samuel, spokesman of the National Salvation Front. He was speaking with me from Tanzania earlier today. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at the Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo. That story is coming up right after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
do you think Africa should become one big country? Why or why not?
I don't think Africa should become one big country because I think smaller countries is easier to govern and to rule.
No, it is impossible. Because now, even in a one state, you would find that it is very difficult for the leaders to manage the one country. So if the whole continent became a one state, it would be impossible for them to manage or to lead it.
If it's going to be headed by one political leader and there's going to be free border and people can move from one place to another easily, I think it's going to be good. It's going to foster investment.
No, I don't think Africa should become one big country. We are too diverse in our culture and way of thinking, and one big country will create chaos.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus, and in our health segment today, we take a look at the Ebola outbreak in DRC. The World Health Organization meets tomorrow to decide if the Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo constitutes a public health emergency of international concern. The question reflects the situation in eastern DRC, where health officials wonder if the situation is getting better or worse. There has been an increase in new cases recently, but that could be caused by by better reporting after initial resistance by local residents to the international aid effort. So everyday aid agencies like Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF, assess constantly changing security situation in active conflict zone and try to help where they can. The death toll has hit 100 from 211 confirmed and suspected cases. John Johnson, MSF's project coordinator for Beni, which has become the outbreak's epicenter, talked with my colleague Paul Alexander about the challenges.
The epidemic is sort of not yet at a stopping point. We still see some active chains of transmission, so it's being very closely followed by the teams that are doing active case finding, by the teams that are doing follow-up of contacts. Of confirmed cases and all the other surveillance teams trying to get a handle on where the cases are coming from, where they're spreading, and trying to be one step ahead of the cases as they show up in new places. I'm located in Beni, and Beni has become the new epicenter of the epidemic. Originally, in early August and September, it was a town about 45 minutes from here called Mangina. The efforts put in place there made it so that today there are no confirmed cases in Mangina. But we're seeing the last couple weeks in Beni, there have been 14, I think, the week that just passed, and 11 the week before that. So we're still working on getting things under control in Beni.
Is there a sense that things are getting better or worse?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's really hard to say from week to week. What I can say is we're finding a lot more alerts than we had before. And that's not necessarily because there's more cases, but it's because the alert system has been improved. So when you see more and more alerts coming in, that doesn't necessarily mean more cases. It just means that we're being more efficient in finding them.
Is security still the main concern, and are your staff concerned about their own safety?
Security definitely poses a lot of challenges in this area because there are certain areas that we have difficulty to access. We've known that. That's nothing new. There's been years of conflict and violence in North Kivu and especially right around this area. So we have to be creative in how we reach out to people. There's certain red zones where we just don't go. And we have to check from day to day what the situation on the ground is before we send out our teams. All that being said, we're able to still do the work, you know, with minor constraints from time to time where we have to stop movements or wait until things calm down. I think this, you know, for the people that live here and our staff are locals, I think this has been their life for so long they've adapted. And they know when to be careful and when to not go out and when things are more calm, when they can, you know, move about freely.
Now, officials have said that they are going to try to crack down on the unsafe burials and bring in troops for security. Have you seen any improvements in that area?
The sort of idea that they're going to enforce this by way of the police, that hasn't been implemented yet. I'd say from our point of view, it's not necessarily the most effective way to get people to cooperate. I think measures that are insensitive work better than measures that are coercive. But, you know, any type of resistance for safe burial practices, for going to the Ebola treatment center, is completely normal and very human. In any Ebola outbreak, you see this. In other Ebola outbreaks, it's often the same story. People don't want to go to the treatment center because it's a very terrifying place to go. You know that in the best case scenario, about 50% of Ebola patients die. The measures that we work on with the rest of the Ebola outbreak response is community awareness campaigns and dialogues to sort of help us understand what are the measures that will get the community to begin to cooperate with this Ebola response. Rather than sort of resist.
That was John Johnson of Doctors Without Borders talking to my colleague Paul Alexandria. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is in Riyadh today in search for answers to the mysterious disappearance of U.S. resident and Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. He was dispatched by President Donald Trump, who was asked Monday about U.S. media reports that Khashoggi was murdered in a botched interrogation after entering the Saudi consulate in Istanbul October 2nd, and Saudi Arabia is preparing to acknowledge this death. David Mack is a scholar at the Middle East Institute and a former ambassador. He told VOA's Victor Bidi, it is easier to pass the blame on anything that goes wrong on lower-level operatives.
Saudi Arabia has been supporting a extremist form of Salafism, Salafi Sunniism, that led to the rise of Al-Qaeda, that has led to far more anti-Western terrorism than anything that Iran has ever done, which is not to excuse Iran. But we have to remember that the far-right Sunni Wahhabist movement is supported by Saudi Arabia and has been for many decades. Secondly, Saudi Arabia has, throughout its history, engaged in human rights policies and abuses against its own people and against people in other countries that, had they not been the world's major oil exporting power, would have earned them massive sanctions from the United States. But like with their behavior in terms of exporting Islamist extremism, the human rights problems both inside and outside the country have not earned them a lot of international sanctions because they do export oil. Similarly, the human rights crisis in Yemen, to which Saudi Arabia has contributed, also has met with a fairly mute response from around the world. But now you have the apparent murder of Mr. Khashoggi. We're waiting for more definitive proof. And this has garnered people's attention. You know, in the same way that the story of Anne Frank is easier to understand than hearing about 6 million Jews being murdered in the Holocaust, Jamal Khashoggi puts a face and a human story with a man about to get married to behavior that the Saudis are engaged in around the world. What is different for Saudi Arabia this time than previous decades is, first and foremost, the U.S. is far more oil independent than we have been in the past. And I think Saudi Arabia recognizes that because of fracking and because of the availability of Canadian energy, we still are reliant on Middle East oil, to be sure, but we are far less reliant on it than we were, say, during the 1970s, during the two oil embargoes.
Iran must be looking on this with some joy.
For two reasons. One is just that Saudi Arabia is its competitor. Saudi Arabia is the center of the export of Sunni extremism. Iran is the center of the export of Shiite extremism. So seeing its competitor and even some might say enemy in this much trouble around the world is going to make the Iranian government feel a certain amount of relief. Secondly, this means that the world is going to need Iranian oil if indeed Saudi Arabia decides to cut back on its exports or to engage in some type of embargo against the West. And that would really put pressure on the European countries and on certain companies not to abide by the U.S. terms of the Iran Sanctions Act. In other words, to go ahead and continue buying oil from Iran, which is what they would like to do anyway.
South Sudanese lawmakers unanimously passed the revitalized peace agreement on the resolution of conflict in South Sudan yesterday and called on leaders of the warring parties to fully implement the deal without delay. One activist urged members of parliament to offer copies of the agreement to their constituencies so people can understand the terms of the deal. Winnie Chirino has more for VOA from Juba.
According to the implementation matrix of the deal, South Sudan's legislatures were supposed to ratify the peace agreement by September 19th, but Paulina Wanawila, Minister for Justice and Constitutional Affairs, argues the parties are not behind schedule.
My worry is not about missing the time. My worry is about not doing something. Even if you miss the time, you can still do something within that answer, the provision of the agreement.
Member of Parliament Genevia Eliaba is calling on all the parties to fully implement the deal.
My expectation is that we need all the two parties to implement what is in the agreement fully. Because our people on the ground, they likely wait to see the final peace in South Sudan.
Samuel Dunar Deng, another member of the parliament, believes that implementing the peace deal will enable millions of South Sudanese who have fled their homes due to deadly fighting for nearly 5 years to return home.
If we implement it, for sure, the people of South Sudan are going to enjoy the outcome of it because Barbora now will have seen himself represented in this agreement. We hedge our people as representatives to build consensus around this agreement so that this agreement brings back the normalcy and reunite people of South Sudan once again.
Lawmaker Magdalene Peter urged the government and the armed opposition to first end the fighting in all parts of the country and work to ensure the country is stable.
As a woman, I still think that the government has to do his best how to bring those who are still outside so that we can have a complete peace and sustainable peace, because we don't want any fighting anymore.
Secretary General for Democratic Change, Deng Bior Deng, says there are unresolved issues with the country's borders, security reforms and power sharing. But still, he is encouraging all parties to focus on implementing the deal without any reservations.
We know that there are difficult situations to go through in its implementation. But what is important is that people must conform to the letter of the peace and implement it properly, not with reservations.
Sheikh Bitali Aligo, chairperson of South Sudan Civil Society Alliance, urges members of parliament to distribute copies of the peace agreement in their home districts so that people know the terms of the agreement.
What is needed by all the parties to the agreement, from the opposition side and the government, is to implement and disseminate this agreement to the grassroots as soon as possible so that we could know the provision of the agreement and the rights of the civilians towards this revitalized agreement.
Members of the National Pre-Transitional Committee, which is tasked with implementing pre-transitional arrangements, are expected to meet this week to work on those provisions before a transitional government is formed. For VOA News, I am Winnie Sereno in Juba.
That's our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the song Halina Shtakal by Lomerika San.
Mashakil d'Afrika gabeli akulu yo. Oh, mafidele katunu soti la jere jere kulu yo. Sala boda boda Deli se shoko. Oh, sala atali zatu Deli se shoko. Kuku kuku ate chejera wara shejera alabu kushana domuna. Wa Mungu la wa wana sasi ya sata alfarid mabu wa dina gita.
Kelina istaka, asha sana belede. Kelina istaka, asha sana belede.
Kelina sibu shoko kasilani ya kona
Kelina istaka.
Kelina sibu dugu kasu magu wa takit ya kona
Kelina istaka.
The hate speak big kelimu. Verdet nina Bisena sifir, sifir, sifir Bikarabunina. We'll create discriminations among our community. Let's stop doing this. Matagul kalamde Kalide jenge Kalide nyamnyam Kalide serwiji Kalamade kulumakwe.
We have been listening to Lomerika San with that song talking about Halina Shtakal, which means let's get down to work. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.